The following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
Frank Cotolo. He just talks and 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 talks and
talks. Secure the template. Set the backside guide to appropriate locks and basket. The backside guide tabs include setting the jig. Possessing template. What the hell am I reading?
Sunburned sickleman of April weary. Neo-postmodernisms. Oh, God. Did you think I was not here? I was here. Oh, God. Make holiday, come hither from the Pharaoh and be merry, because wake up, it's night, it's time, Narati, couple servers, net of hawks and infomaniacs, philosophical entertainment and relevant irreverence, and in very important stuff about your universe, the space where you live, the places where you go, and the places you'll never see, with Tom Savino and me, and Dr. Waldorf. Tell him, Phil.
冰球到冰球，小村到大市， 咸湿屋仔到咸湿中心。 Cthulhu Chronicles.
From ice cap to ice cap, from hound to what is wrong with my mouth? He talks and talks and talks. From ice cap to ice cap, from Hamlet to city, from Othello and into every bordello. I don't know, maybe too much coffee, maybe too much caffeine. I think we should start by moving right along. My name is Frank Cotolo, man whose name joins the title of the show. Is Tom there? I told him I'd call. I'm going to figure out how to do this. There's going to be three of us. three of us here. And, Tom is Savino's joining us. Let's see if. What happened? What is this? Ah, a little trouble there. Let's see if this works. That was weird. Skype acting dumb. Let's see if Tom's there. Tom's there.
Yes. Yes, I am.
Skype is acting dumb. It said I don't have a video hookup. Is that true?
I don't see you, but no. I hear you.
Yeah, but I don't see you. I tried to call you video call, and it didn't work.
Huh.
Now everybody knows. That it's okay. We can talk.
We're on the air?
Yeah, we're on the air. We're here.
Okay, yes, we are on the air. So
we're on the air, the Bard Broadcasting, the two Bards. Can there be two Bards? Two Bards for the price of one?
Yes, absolutely. In this universe, there could be two Bards, but one is a particle and the other is a wave.
Well, I'm a commander. Commander Cotolo here at Chronicling, and it's a week. This is what happened, friends, my comrades. Can't say comrades these days. Too many people upset about that crap. Here's what happened, fellow listeners. I'm a fellow listener. I'm not a listener. I don't listen to what I say. You listen to what I say. Here's what happened. It was the came time for the week for Tom to be on, and time for the month. It's that time of the month.
It's that time of the month.
And then Dr. Waldock gets in touch with me. He says, by golly, sorry I didn't get back to you, but I can do the show this week. And that was last week. And I said, well, no, because last week I have on Grace Williams was here live in the studio. And so we couldn't do it. So I said, how about the 24th? And that's when Tom had already booked. People out there don't have any idea of the complexity of putting this show together. I like to make them think that. And then Dr. Waldo said, well, that'd be great. I said, would you mind being on with Tom? I think that would be great because Tom's rather, he's a teacher and he knows this stuff. And you've never talked to Dr. Waldo.
No, but I've been impressed with him, responding to tweeting, I guess, a couple of responses, like during the Tonto joke thing and some other things. And I was impressed with the things he said and seems to have a sense of humor.
Oh, you're a smart guy, Tom. Oh, yeah. My goodness. I mean, this is beyond. But you know what? He's not smart like our New York Institute of Technology professors.
I mean, like he's really smart.
Yeah. Well, he's one of us, and he just happens to have this heightened intelligence, and still he's one of us because he's our generation, our age, and uh-huh. Not like those guys who I don't know where they were coming from, but they. You know, and still they live with us. That's why we ask everybody to take out your Cotolo Chronicles notebook. As you hear things this evening, this afternoon, or whenever you're listening, whether you're listening live or later on the many different stations that run us during the week, you will hear things, and we're not going to annotate everything we say. You write it down. You do what Dr. Fablianic said.
Quick, write it down.
See, nobody believed me. Well, I don't know if they believe me, but I got people walking around saying, write this down! And so you do that, and then later on you find out what's going on. So these professors live, but anyone who's a listener, a regular of this show knows that Dr. Waldor is indeed, and you got a great sense of humor too, which is, you have to have. You can't be on this show and not have a good sense of humor, otherwise you're done for. You never come on again.
Yeah.
Some people, you know, Tom, some people never come on again. They come on once.
Yeah. I think we had discussed that. I think they take things too seriously and...
Absolutely.
Get offended, maybe, if, you know.
They sense that I'm making fun of them.
And, yes.
And not of the world we live in that includes them.
Yeah.
What else is happening? Let's see, before we get Dr. Waldor and I figure out how to actually do this again and have a three-way conversation. If indeed something happens, Tom, we'll just call you back. We'll pick it up, so don't go away.
Okay.
Let me tell everybody else what is happening that we know about. This is April 24th. This is as far as we went, even through January when we were booking the daylights out of this, out of these weeks. I think we got one more. No, this is the end. This is it for April. We're going into May. We're going to have our Cambodian cocktails, cocktail hour.
Cambodian cocktail hour.
We're going to have a Cambodian cocktail hour, which for those of you who don't know, I've been getting a lot of requests on sitting, you know, by the piano and doing songs and just singing and stuff like that. So I never want to do that seriously. So what I do, Tom should know that if no one else knows. So I said, I will do it. I told the, by popular demand, I said, but when I get the piano tuned. And now Phil Hong, who runs SRM Media Works, along with the other guys and gals up there, said, you don't have to tune the piano. He said, why don't you do it like the Cambodians do it? They play out of tune. Now, the piano is not that out of tune. It's just a little out of register, and there's one note that, you know, sticks.
Uh-huh.
So I said, okay, why don't we do a Cambodian cocktail hour, which, of course, would be 2 hours or thereabouts, where I'm going to sit over there. We're going to have some people in the studio here, and they're going to shout out things. I'm going to make up songs, do the old Steve Allen thing, and who knows, maybe we'll sing real songs and do the junk that we do when we're live, if anybody is in town to come by and hear us once a month at St. Thomas Roasters, which does not sponsor the show, but what the hell. I'll mention them anyway. Yeah. So we're going to do that sometime in May. We're also waiting to hear.
Am I invited to that?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
I mean, absolutely. We'll let you know. And you can come on and shout out songs or sing. You could actually sing along while we could do harmonies and stuff, I think.
Oh, cool. I got my guitar here. I got my Ovation. That's the only Ovation I'll ever get.
Is it standing in the corner?
Yeah, I got to stand for the Ovation.
It's only standing.
Now a standing Ovation.
We're waiting to hear from Robin Matthews. Last we heard, she skipped Paris and went to New York. You know, I knew this was going to happen. Before the Academy Awards, Robin said to me, I said, why don't you be on before the Academy Awards? Because you're nominated. But she was way too excited. She was way too, you know, she's a woman too. Right? A woman going to the Academy Awards, whether they're nominated or not, are going to spend a month getting ready with dress and things, you know.
Gowns, hair.
So I said, Robin, let me run some of the other stuff we did. And she said, no, we'll do a new one. I knew this was going to happen because I knew she was going to win. And by golly, she did. She won an Academy Award. And we're going to, and then, you know, immediately the scripts came in. She had to run around and tour. Everybody wanted a piece of her. I've always wanted a piece of her, but that's another story altogether. So Robin said, okay, wait, I got a couple of countries to visit. I love this. Here's the excuse to be. Here's the reason I can't be on Cartolo Chronicles. This is funny. Not everyone says this. I got a couple of countries to visit. I got my book. I got 5 scripts to read. And God knows, you know, when I'm going to get to the bank. I must do it. And she's promised, and she's always kept her promise. She will be on the show eventually here as things calm down from the Academy Awards. And then we have some other things that are going to happen, and I don't have a lot of other names because people haven't committed. So how are you, Mr. Savino, in this world
I'm well, and you might like to know, or I'm sure you'd like to know, that I had a long conversation with old buddy of ours, Tom Martin.
Ah, I meant to ask that of you. Yes. How did that work out? Tom, let me tell everyone out there, because it doesn't want to, like, you're not listening to a conversation you know nothing about.
Yes.
Tom Savino and I, of course, were victims of, in college, of the New York Institute of Technology. And one of our, a very close-knit bunch of guys in the communications department, one of which was Thomas Martin. And that's who Tom is talking about. Now, Tom, you haven't talked to Thomas Martin in how long?
It's been decades. Yeah.
Wow.
Been a long time.
And it was a long conversation?
We had a long conversation. Somehow he found me on. I had been writing to him at an email address I had for him, and I thought, you know, as my therapist reminded me, why would I think this? But you know, I thought he didn't want to talk to me because he wasn't answering. But it turns out his email, he doesn't use that email anymore.
There you go.
So, but somehow he found me on Twitter. And we reconnected, and we talked. And he would like to do a show with us about the New York Institute of Technology.
That would be great, and we can invite all those people there who continually ask me for money for the Alumni Association.
Yeah.
But will not print in their graduate section a paragraph about me. Do you believe this?
Really?
Yeah, they just won't. It's like, so I don't know why, because, you know, I don't know why. I can't talk for them, but we will talk and we'll get in touch with them because they have a whole new website also where they're getting all the people who went to the school over the decades, to talk and, you know, they're doing their own little Facebook thing. Yes. Does Tom have Skype?
He said he would, he has a Kindle and he said, oh, I can get Skype on my Kindle.
Really?
So, he doesn't have it, but,
you can talk on a Kindle?
He would. Can you, could Skype on a Kindle.
But can you talk on a Kindle? Or is it just Skype?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay. I thought you could just read books.
No, it's just like a, you know, computer.
I thought Kindle was just a book reading computer. I guess I don't know much about that either, do I?
No, you could, my wife and I use hers all the time to watch TV, stream it from there to the TV some magical way that.
Okay. I really shouldn't question technology because
it's
a little ridiculous. And there's probably a million things that are done that I don't know about, even though I've been here from the beginning, which makes me sound like Ben Franklin.
Yeah.
And the only
you want to feel this? Is, you know, I'm approaching retirement. I have actually 29 days left.
I was going to ask us, this is the summer of your discontent.
Yes, or my soon to be content.
It'll be discontent, though. No, actually, the last summer would be a summer of your discontent. It's a highly a misunderstood phrase, Tom, but go ahead.
Apparently.
Yes, go ahead. You will be happy this summer because you will not be working, right?
I will not be working this summer, yeah. So, why would I be discontent? Wouldn't I be content?
No, this is the winter of my discontent. Said Henry the whoever, Richard the Third, or one of those Richards.
The winter of my discontent.
Yeah, it was the winter of my discontent. He said it because it meant this is the end of all my troubles.
Okay, now I got you.
So, yeah. And so winter, that's why winter, because it's the last before the cycle.
I should know that.
You should. You teach this stuff. I just say it. And you know, and I talk and talk and talk and talk.
But as I, you know, I'm approaching the end here. And
we want to be there at the end, Tom.
And looking forward to it. And, you know, it's exciting and frightening in a way, too. But my sister wrote me and she sent me a link to my high school, Bishop Ford High School in Brooklyn, New York, that is closing down. They're closing down because and they had been hounding me for decades to. You know, be an alumnus who helps them with donations, but I never did. Not that I don't think I'm solely responsible
That's why,
for
yeah.
their closing. But
maybe Pope Francis had something to say about it too.
Yeah, Tom Martin actually said maybe Pope Francis could, you know, if he knew, he'd keep it up there. the school, that is.
Yeah. Okay. And why does this come to
our attention? It just made me feel so old.
Oh. Well,
Super,
you know.
I mean, whose high school closes down, you know? Yeah, the old high school's closed. I mean, it's like, you know.
I don't know. I don't have the statistics on that, but if you find it amusing, then it's fine with me. whose high school closes down? I went to Shallow Junior High School, right?
Yeah.
I had two teachers that my father had.
Really?
Yeah, that's
wow.
how
wow.
Those things don't happen anymore. Now the school's not even there, no less the teachers are still there from generations.
I've never had that. That probably would have killed me on the spot if but ironically tonight is parent night, and I want you to know, Frank,
yes.
Solo, I've never missed a parent night ever.
That's a parent. So you're
until tonight.
Wow. Well, you
and
know,
I chose to do the Curtolo Chronicles.
Don't you know all those parents anyway?
Yes, and I'm sick of them.
Let's make note of that. All you, all the students of Tom who might be listening. That, well, you know, so what? Thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
I thank you for that. Because.
Oh, you're welcome.
I don't think you're going to be sorry either, because when we start talking about gravitational waves, playing ping pong on a moving train, and any other number of things that go on with Dr. Waldor, please feel free to ask him any questions as we go along. And we have to look for little spots where we could stop and say, I don't like to ruin his train of thought, but at the same time, sometimes I keep saying, Doc, come, you know, come, because I don't understand a lot of stuff. You know, I don't understand it. I know a lot of people who listen don't understand it, even though I'm sure, I'm absolutely sure, and I could document the fact that I appeal to thin me. Is it far smarter than I, or far smarter than me?
It would be far smarter. Nice. Far smarter than I.
So we're going to skip selling books and doing all sorts of crap that goes on anyway. We're going to tell everybody that if you want to find out about books, you know, 148.ca/Frank, and you might want to go over there one time or another this week anyway. This week's column is a speech I gave to doctors. I think it's the American Medical Association. You'll enjoy that. And then, of course, every Friday at the Montreal Jewish News, which is connected to True Talk Radio up there in Quebec. My political pulp column, which is turning out to be a tremendous success.
Very good.
Beats the living daylights out of me. But, you know, it's great to have readers, because that's why we write. We don't have readers.
Yes.
Yeah, right. So what now I'm going to do is I'm going to hit this plus button, because I know Doc Waldor is sitting there, and I'm going to add, so move this mic over right to here. You're listening to Cotolo Chronicles. It's Y2K Plus 14, with the 24th, this is the last show of April, Y2K plus 14, and we're going to push this plus button right now and go right into it. There's going to be no interruptions. Uh-oh. It says, and send contacts, add people to this call. Here we go. Now we have to find, because I know he's online. Here he is, Dr. Andrew. Oh, where'd he go? Come on. Andrew Waldor, add to call. This should work perfectly. You there, Tom?
I'm here.
Okay.
Add people to this call. Here we go. Now we have to find, because I know he's
alive. Ah, he's, you know, there's not supposed to be a delay, and yet there's
a delay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Andrew Waldor, had to call. This should work perfectly.
It's so.
Here my. Here we go.
This is, you know what this is, Tom? This is, turn down your radio, please. Turn down your radio. Dr. Waldor.
How are you?
Hey, I'm fine. Can you get a little closer to the mic?
I can talk a little louder.
Can you talk a little louder into the mic?
Yeah, I can. How are you? And Tom, how are you?
I'm fine. Good to hear you.
I'm introducing you here. Tom knows of you. You know of Tom.
Yes, absolutely. I never miss a show. I never miss a Cotolo Savino show.
Wow, that's great. Thank you very much.
That's him, Tom. That's the one who never misses.
I'm the one.
Yes, you're the one.
Dr. Waldor, of course, for listeners who listen all the time, and I know there are many of you, one way or another, he teaches at Villanova, and he is the professor of higher learning spatial universe things. What is your title again, Doc? I don't know.
It's just a full professor of mathematics.
Oh, mathematics, that's it, mathematics, which I, you know, at the level I know mathematics, I enjoy it, but at the level, you know, you talk about, I struggle. Tom, of course, is a teacher, and I guess when you were learning to teach, Tom, aside from your specific area, you learned other things, didn't you?
Yes.
The subjects?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last
other
part.
Subjects, you're right. I mean, you had to pass things in math and things in science.
Yeah. This is very weird, but when I took the teaching test, even though I'm teaching English, I had to take different disciplines for the test, and I actually scored higher in math, which blew me away, because I suck at math. I just am not a math person, but I scored higher in math than I did in English.
So, Doc, what you're going to have to do is talk very slowly so Tom can understand. Because he may suck in math more than I suck in math, or your kind of math. But the kind of math that Dr. Waldor teaches is what? What do you teach every day? Really understand that either. You go in and what is the curriculum? What's the title of your courses that you do here?
Okay, well, this semester I'm teaching two sections of multivariable calculus, which is also known as Calc 3. And in the fall, I usually teach one course for the major. It could be coding theory, combinatorics, graph theory, group theory.
String theory?
No, no. No. I don't teach.
String cheese?
String cheese.
He collects string. Okay, so the stuff we talk about here, you know what I want to mention? Since you've been, since the last time you were on, which wasn't the last time you were on, because now you're on again, since the most recent time you were on this show, your name, they talked about you in the Congress of the United States, is that correct?
Yeah, in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Now, it's not exactly...
For or against you?
It's not exactly a body of people in the favor of Americans these days, but what exactly did they do?
They commended me for contributions to algebraic graph theory, and they commended the National Science Foundation because I got an award to run a conference in algebraic graph theory, and I tell you, that is a lot of work.
Really? It sounds so simple.
Well, I should have to do it.
No, of course.
It is. Trying to regulate, you know, my wife and some really very great and competent people at Villanova are all helping.
Is your wife a professor as well?
No, she's not. She actually was a dean at University of Pennsylvania before she, I'll say retired. She just left that position.
But believe me, Tom, she's smarter than both of us put together, too.
Okay. You know what? You told me the subject was going to be gravitational waves.
Yeah.
And I started brushing up on it, and after 10 minutes, I said, there's no way I can even brush. There's no brushing up on this. I the concepts are just beyond me. It's hard to grasp. So help us out here, Doc.
Well, we try to bring it down. Dr. Waldo always brings it down to the level that even you and I can understand. So first, what we're going to do is because that is the topic, based on a recent, something that happened recently that changed or altered the paradigm of thinking in terms of the universe or something. So Dr. Waldo is going to explain that, and then we'll ask some questions that everyone would ask.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. It did change the paradigm. This is paradigm shifting news. First, though, what I want to do is kind of straighten out some things. You know, some of the reports are very misleading. So many reports in the media state that this is the first direct detection of gravitational waves. I've seen that everywhere. And there's actually two things wrong with that, with statement or with that. First, the method of detection was not direct. It was indirect. No one directly detected gravitational waves. What they did detect is predicted effects of gravitational waves on light from the cosmic microwave background. And I'll get into that later. More specifically, though, they detected polarized light. Also, this is not the first time that gravitational waves have been indirectly detected, as they were here. There was also, in 1993, two professors at Princeton, Hulse and Taylor, won the Nobel Prize in Physics for doing the same thing, for detecting detecting gravitational waves indirectly via polarized light. It was really the same type of experiment, except that the findings were not as experimentally convincing. So I want to add, since I'm kind of like talking about the media, that they may be jumping the gun. So let me say that if the experiment is valid, then we have, if it really is the case that gravitational waves have been detected, this is earth-shattering news.
Can you say, of course you can, I mean, why don't you tell us how whoever these people happened to be, how did they find it? Were they looking for gravitational waves? Did they suddenly wake up one day and were they hurled out of their bed? It's like, oh my God, we've detected gravitational waves. I mean, were they looking? And where did they find it? And how do you find it? You got instruments or telescope? What?
Oh yeah, they were looking. They had instruments, telescopes on the South Pole. They were looking specifically for polarized light in the cosmic microwave background. and I'll discuss what that is. For now, I'll just say it is the oldest light that you can see in the universe. And I do want to say, though, that what happens is before, you know, there are still a lot of scientific people in the scientific community who are skeptical. They want to see this experiment repeated and verified to be what's called a five sigma finding. And this is just a statistical notion. Five sigma finding is kind of the benchmark that propels an experiment into what they would consider a bona fide discovery. It's just a notion that statistically it establishes likelihood of experimental error to be so small that it cannot be by chance. So one of the problems, by the way, is that if you remember the very embarrassing faster-than-light neutrinos.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Damn neutrinos, huh? They didn't worry. That was a mistake.
That was an embarrassing equipment-related error. And unfortunately, this is part of the reason why the scientific community wants to see the experiment not only repeated, corroborated many times, but by different experimental teams. It's because I mentioned the five sigma finding, but this is only relative to measurement, experimental measurement. Some errors are also due to flawed equipment. Some are due to poorly conceived experimental design. So I would just say, let's slow down and wait. Let's not get too excited too quickly about it.
Yeah, well, don't break out the champagne as is happening across the state borders here in the United States, especially, where people are ready to just party at the finding of directional gravity. I'm not making fun of you. You know what I'm talking about, Doc. I mean, who is celebrating and why, I mean, you're bringing us the news that it didn't happen. We found it, but they found it, but we didn't find it. Tom, are you following this?
Yes, I am.
Good.
I'm following it, but
I
need some remedial
go ahead.
Understanding here.
Yeah, a little specific about the actual experiment itself. This is, again, through telescopes. It's called the BICEP 2 experiment. What I want to stress, if gravitational waves were not directly detected, the real question is, what was detected? And the answer is polarized light. So normal light from the sun or from a lamp or a candle, this is unpolarized. Essentially what that means is that the light scatters in all directions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not all waves scatter in all directions. The reason this happens with light is because light is an electromagnetic wave. So it actually has two component waves, an electric wave and a magnetic wave. And these components, they oscillate in planes that are right angles to each other. You know, like, for example, the ceiling and a wall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, light can be polarized. That's the point. This happens, for example, whenever you put on a pair of glare-reducing sunglasses, you're polarizing light. Or if you take a picture through a Polaroid lens, you're polarizing the light. And technically what you're doing is you're reducing this two-plane oscillation I just mentioned to oscillation within a single plane. Mm. Okay, so this is actually what they were able to find, that light had been polarized, but this is light that's, again, coming from the the CMB, as it's called, the cosmic microwave background. So Einstein's theory of general relativity predicts the existence of gravitational waves, but Newtonian physics does not.
Now, from the little research I did, and it was definitely little, but it's related to the birth of the universe. Is that correct? I mean, it would be, if we were actually, for sure, able to say we have detected gravitational waves, we would basically be saying we have detected the birth of the universe. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, except for one thing. The gravitational waves can be generated even today. I mean, in any time, any acceleration that's not spherically or cylindrically symmetric is going to produce gravitational waves. But here we're talking about a very special situation. We're talking about gravitational waves that polarized light from the CMB. This is the oldest light in the universe.
Does that mean it's dead? I mean, is this light traveling that's dead, like a star?
No. It's continually traveling.
It's still, so it's just getting here? I'm confused, seriously.
Yeah, I mean, when they see it in the, for a long time, they've been able to see the light. You have to understand the expansion of the universe. The universe is expanding at a rate that's greater than the speed of light.
Wow.
So what happens is, this is what causes this dichotomy between what we call the observable universe and the non-observable universe. What's non-observable is stuff that actually occurred before when the universe was 380,000 years old. So about a third of a billion years old. Okay, so what happens is the CMB, the light in the CMB, is actually right at the boundary between observable and unobservable. Okay, so what happens is there is light that we cannot see and never hope to see. Okay, because the universe is expanding at too great a rate for that light to ever reach us.
Where is this light coming from in the galaxies? Where is this light shoot come? Where is it coming? Where does it originate?
It's all over. I mean the fact it originally, well, light can come from various light sources. Okay, so you certainly have that. You also have all reflective sources. Light can reflect off of objects. But light is everywhere.
Okay.
So what's happening here, though, is you have to understand that when you're talking about the very early universe, you're talking about the entire universe being of a size that was roughly 1 billionth the size of a proton. And then what happened is that you have this cosmic inflation that occurred at such an incredible rate, much, much faster than the speed of light, that spread the universe out. And I'll talk about cosmic inflation because it's part of the inflationary Big Bang model. There are two types. There are lots of Big Bang theories, but they fall into two types, the conventional Big Bang model and the inflational model. And the inflationable.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No problem.
Ask away.
Ask away. Well, this might be a digression a bit, but when I hear these discussions and I over the years, I always have this philosophical question that, like you said, for instance, the size of the universe then was like a minuscule, a ridiculously minuscule, hardly measurable thing almost, right?
Exactly, yeah.
But my philosophical question is, where was it? if it existed, then where was it? Like,
yeah.
What was it? Just space, empty space, just what?
See,
you know.
This is the problem. This is the question doesn't make sense. And it's something you have to really wrestle with. The fact is, there was no space. You see, what comprised this billionth, 1 billionth of a proton-sized universe, all of space and time was in there. There's nothing on the outside. So this is not expanding into any pre-existing space. This is actually expanding, and therefore the universe and time are both being, you know, space-time, the geometry of space-time. They're both being created from allegedly this Big Bang, and these gravitational waves that they're citing in the CMB, they're the first tremors of the Big Bang. So literally the aftershock of the Big Bang.
Right. So that's why, if it's actually proven to be detected, it's a big deal because verifying the Big Bang.
Yes, although there's still a lot to verify as to what type of Big Bang. So I want to get into that because I am a proponent of the inflationary Big Bang theory.
Doc Waldo always asks for so much. He really, this is, I think, what makes you brilliant. Yeah. Because, you know, we'd be happy to just know they found one gravitational wave. You know, and there's millions of them that prove that could prove the origin of the universe. And you're going, yeah, but they gotta do, but if they don't do this, if they don't do it, you gotta watch it because, you know, there's kinks along the way, or chinks along the way, or in the armor here, and I'm just trying to find the basic one. So by the way, everyone listening, you must know this is Cthulhu Chronicles, Sir Y2K plus 14. Tom Savino and Dr. Andrew Waldo are with us. We're talking about, we're trying to get to the bottom of the gravitational wave discovery, which, if, I'm going to say this very simply now for everyone again, just to catch up, which, if proven true, has something to do with verifying the Big Bang. And I want to mention this as long as we're doing this, and we don't have to go into a discussion about this, but you know there was a poll done this week. Maybe you know about this, Doc. There was a poll done this week that said that, oddly enough, people 18 through 29 years old in this particular poll have a problem with believing in the Big Bang theory at all. It shocked scientists, and maybe you must know about this, don't you?
No, I hadn't heard of that.
Wow, you better look this one up.
What's the percentage, Frank? Was it?
The percentage, it was the majority of people surveyed.
Wow.
Said that there are a couple of things they don't know if they believe at all. They don't, the theory of the Big Bang, they're not convinced in that, and they weren't convinced in something else. The only thing they were convinced of, there were certain scientific things they were not convinced about. One of them was the Big Bang Theory. Mm. You can look it up. It's somewhere on your internet news stream. But anyway, so now you're saying that if this happens, that particular bunch of people they should start believing it, right? They should start saying, hey.
Well, actually, I don't think they're going to continue to disbelieve. The source of their disbelief is just a lack of understanding. That's all. I mean, it's very hard to swallow a lot of these things.
Well, what is so hard to swallow about the creation of the universe by a big explosion that caused all these?
Not an explosion.
Huh?
Not an explosion.
Okay, a bang.
No, not a bang.
Not a bang either.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'll be honest with you.
What?
The Big Bang Theory was never about a bang.
No, they just needed a good title.
It's a bad name. In fact, most cosmologists would prefer to call it the Big Whoosh.
The Big Whoosh.
And we all know the difference between a whoosh and a bang, don't we?
No, even for this, it's an explosion. You see, it propels matter outward into pre-existing space. And this is not at all what happens. In fact, I'll get into it later.
Okay.
Later about why you should not think of the Big Bang as a force that's coming internally and pushing things outward. You have to think of it as an external force that's pulling.
Well, that I think you're getting close to my confusion or. My difficulty in grasping this information, because I always imagined, when I hear the Big Bang theory and all that, I imagined, well, it was in a pre-existing space and it was an explosion. But it's not a pre-existing space. You're saying this minuscule universe at one time included space that we now...
It's all of space. It was not only that; it was all of time.
Wow!
That really stopped us dead, didn't it? It was all of time, and everybody just went, the mind is finite. This is the problem that we have, Tom and I. Yours apparently.
Yeah. Is not. You see, we're a couple of old Newtonians here. I guess that's our problem.
Yeah, we're very Newtonian. There are several different issues I'll raise that, you know, about Newtonian versus Einsteinian physics. The important thing I have to mention is type of polarization that they found. It's related There's two types, is, you know, I won't go over this really, but one type, B mode and E mode, which are referring to curl and gradient. I'm saying this for the benefit of calculus students who might have heard these terms. And the type that they found is B mode polarization. And the problem is this, excuse me, that although this B mode polarization is theoretically predicted by general relativity, it can also result from something called gravitational lensing. And this occurred at much later times. Okay, it's occurring now. So the goal of the experiment is to minimize the effects of gravitational lensing. And this is allegedly what the experimenters are claiming that they've done. The key is this. Once polarization due to gravitational lensing is accounted for and found to contribute only a portion of the B-mode polarization that's been observed by experiment, then gravitational waves becomes the only viable explanation for the source of the remaining polarization. And that's what we mean by the indirect detection.
I see.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah. So really clearly, I see. No, I'm getting a little insight on that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Could you comment on this analogy that I picked up in my little research? The analogy of the what a gravitational wave is. They said, imagine a mattress, okay? An ordinary mattress, all right? And you put a bowling ball in the middle of the mattress. And what happens? Well, the mattress sags from the weight of the ball. Mm-hmm. The whole mattress sags. But then they said, now, gravitational wave would be, imagine the mattress is a waterbed.
Mm-hmm.
And you did the same thing. You put the bowling ball in the waterbed, and those ripples would be the gravitational wave.
That's correct.
Does that gel with you, or?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. In fact, various, a whole variety of wave motions are described that way. But here's the thing, that even though we're talking about this prior to inflation, expansion of the universe, that we have the entire universe the size of 1/1 billion of a size of a proton, what happened is, at that point, of course, gravitational waves had a very small wavelength. They had to. But the universe expanded so dramatically, exponentially, and much faster than the speed of light, so that these gravitational waves that they're looking for here, they would now, at this point, be a billion light years in length. And this is why they're so hard to detect. Because the way you observe waves is by their wavelength, right? The distance between troughs.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why direct detection, it would require a level of technology that's virtually inconceivable, at least by today's standards.
Well, now, since you brought up that subject, what is this LIGO instrument? L-I-G-O, LIGO?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Let me clear this up for you.
You're going to clear it up for
me? No, I don't know. Legos?
LIGO, L-I-G-O. It stands for, and apparently we paid for it. We taxpayers paid for this. Where is it? It's somewhere in the United States. And it's short for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory.
Okay. Well, now it makes more sense to me. That's what it is.
Hey, go self-explanatory.
No, we have a couple of them. One in Washington and one in Louisiana.
Yeah, these are enormous imaging telescopes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, you see this whole the experiment goes by the name, this latest experiment that's getting all the hoopla.
Uh-huh.
Goes by the name BICEP 2 experiment, and the 2 means it's the second one that they've done. But BICEP stands for Background Imaging of Cosmic Extragalactic Polarization. You know, so all these things had these names. In fact, you know, it's really funny. There's a theory. Frank will like this too. You're both like this. There's something called WIMPs.
WIMPs?
Yeah, when trying to explain about dark matter, one of the theories, this stands for weakly interactive massive particles.
WIMPs.
That's a great name,
yeah.
WIMPs, you got LIGOs and you got BICEP. I mean, you know. So I don't really keep track of what all these things stand for. Of course, GR is general relativity. CMB is cosmic microwave background. Other than that, you know, I don't really pay much attention.
All right.
What about that bowling ball on the mattress? What did that have to do? you lost me there.
The mattress example is perfect.
I mean, see that? I knew Tom would be of assistance in this particular.
Well, thank you. I'm glad my little proton of information here. So.
You but, know, you sell yourself short like that. The first of all, the thing about the bowling ball, though, that's created in the waterbed, you can see that wave is not very long. And just imagine that you're searching. Imagine that the waterbed is a billion light years long. What that means is that it takes a billion years for light to travel from one end of the wavelength to the other.
Wow.
So it's exactly, your analogy is perfect, but it's of such a broad size.
Pack a lunch.
Pack a lunch.
Yeah, that's a long way.
So, millions of light years.
Billions.
Billions.
We're seeing,
billions and billions.
Yeah, when we're talking in the six and seven digits here, we're talking in, wow. I was mentioning last week because I was talking about the new Cosmos series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And aside from, once I got through the fact that their grammar is horrible, I went on, I went on to the scope of the enormity of the stuff that is talked about and the minute portion of it that is us.
Mm. Yeah.
Is fascinating to me. So when we're talking about this stuff, when we have to go back and talk about the beginning of the universe, it's way beyond our counting it, no less on all our digits, right? I mean, when we're talking about these gravitational waves, we're talking about things that go way back. I mean, before the universe. But when the universe comes about, a lot of people just go like, yeah, man, what? Our life started to form, but realizing that on that calendar that Tyson mm-hmm. makes, and he says that, you know, what we know as human, our ability to comprehend the length because of us in our short lifespan in relationship to mankind, but we're just like on the 31st of December in this yearly calendar of the beginning of the universe to now, that we're like just
the beginning of the universe. That's the calendar for the beginning of Earth.
Oh, not the universe, right.
Oh, in fact, even less than that. I mean, that's just evolution.
Okay.
That's evolution of man.
So what I'm saying is we're trying to understand something that is beyond.
You can't even put it into terms that make it easier to grasp.
I mean,
you're right. I mean, the smallness is so infinitesimal and the largeness is so infinite. I mean, it's just incredible. You know, you just get used to it after a while if you're a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but the fact of the matter is, it's just beyond imagination.
And those of you who are, I don't mean listeners, I mean you scientists who are getting into this stuff and doing it every day, of course it becomes, you know, part of your lifestyle and you just it's easier for you to accept, you know, sit back and think about it and then suddenly have to take a Tylenol. So what I'm always trying to do when we talk about these things on the show is to get this to a spot where we actually understand an effect it has. That's affect it has upon us. Finding the we always talk about this doctor. Yeah. If they find. Or did I jump ahead and miss about a million things you wanted to say?
Probably.
Okay.
the problem, the The problem with that question, as the answer so many times is, the answer here is the same. It's very difficult to try and understand how these discoveries are going to have an impact, in a practical sense, in a pragmatic sense. The great answer is that they're going to give us information about the universe, about the early universe. They're going to corroborate a lot of theories that people have that are really very spectacular if you think about it. But most people won't regard this as very practical.
But in a sense, if people, I guess the impact is based upon, like in that poll, it's based upon the fact that no matter how it's brought down to the least common denominator to make a common person understand it, they're going to still go, yeah, but, but then should I not go to church on Sunday? You know what I mean?
I was just thinking, this is exactly what I was thinking.
I mean, it has to have a monumental impact as long as people, understand they don't have to understand the enormity of it and write and be able to fill a blackboard with a equation, but they have to understand that a lot of the things our little pipsqueak mankind is it's bigger than that. It's bigger than our own understanding.
That's correct. That's
well, when is that going to happen? I mean, there's already so much, and then we have a poll of people going, I don't know about that. I think a big hand just came out because that from the heavens and said, here, here's a ball. Let's start life on there that looks like me. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It has to be so simple.
No, the thing is, it's not enough to reduce it to the common denominator because the common denominator is still outside of most people's grasp. It really depends on the person. The person has to have an interest, a vested interest in trying to understand. And I claim that if someone has a vested interest and does enough of the research and reads enough of the articles, a certain training process that you undergo when you're doing this, you find that you are brought closer and closer to an understanding, even if you never really achieve the understanding at a scientific level. You can definitely achieve an appreciation. Mm-hmm. But it's up to the person. It's up to the person.
Well, you're inspiring me to, I am now going to, not now. But later now.
Saying it twice definitely clears it up. You mean big big or now or I love that.
Not this moment because we're on the radio.
There you go.
But later.
Use your words, Tom. Use your words.
I am going to meditate now on and not try. See, I think I was trying. I cannot, when I try, I cannot grasp the concept of the universe, or the event of the Big Bang, or the Big Whoosh, I can't grasp it as occurring nowhere. I mean, there had to be somewhere. But I also understand that this is an obstacle in my thinking, perhaps, and I should just, you know, ease in, meditate on it, and not think about it, not try to understand it or something.
You're absolutely right. I mean, what you have to do, is let some of this stuff just wash over you.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you might be trying too hard to grasp it. And what happens, you see, I've said this on many shows that I was on in the past, on Cthulhu Chronicles, that it's really difficult to just go in and try to understand these concepts because we're products of our environment. And all of our thinking is based on what we could actually see. And it turns out that the universe is much different than what we can see. In fact, a lot of our intuition is actually wrong. It's counterintuitive. And the only way that you can find this platform by which you can even start to think about some of these concepts Some of it involves trying to untrain yourself. Some of it involves trying to forget what you know, what you think you know. And it's a long process. It's philosophical. And I like the word meditate. You're exactly right. What you want to do is read some of this stuff, have an open mind, and try not to get so involved with every picayune part of it. And just stay at it enough until all of a sudden you find that you're starting to think about things a different way. And, you know, like Skylar Hall, he was my student, and he mentioned that in one of his astrophysics classes, they spent the entire semester trying to just learn how to think.
Mm.
And by the way, that's Skylar Hall of HotspotRadio.net. He has an excellent show.
Right here on SRN, yeah.
Right here on SRN 1 Media Works, right. Yeah, so anyway, to give you some ideas, so to get back, if I may.
Yes.
I wanted to explain that if the light from the cosmic wave background just gives us a glimpse of the universe when it was 380,000 years old, what actually does the gravitational waves, the detection of gravitational waves do? And it's amazing. This takes us back, ready for this now, this takes us back to 10 to the minus 35th seconds. That's 1 divided by 1 followed by 35 zeros. Seconds.
Well, just count me down. 29, wow. 30, 31. I'm writing the zeros. I'm writing this down. So go ahead.
Now, one thing I want to get discuss is I mentioned that gravitational waves were a part of the theory of general relativity, but not in Newton's theory. And since we all tend to think of, you know, Newtonian physics, you know, where particles are billiard balls, which is far from the truth, but this is the way we think, you know, billiard balls. In trying to get away with that, I'd like to emphasize why general relativity is predicting gravitational waves exist, but Newtonian physics does not. And the reason for this is that according to Newton's laws, the gravitational effect of one object on another is instantaneous. And this is regardless of how distant the two objects are from one another. Okay?
Could you repeat that again, the last sentence?
Right, sure. According to Newtonian physics, that's my cat. The gravitational effect of one object on another is instantaneous, regardless of how distant the two objects are. How far away they are. Now, what this means, according to Newton, is if gravity were to travel in waves, these waves would have to be traveling at infinite speed. Otherwise,
see. But, I get that.
Yeah, very good. But you see, here's the thing. Information can only travel at or below the universal speed limit. The universal speed limit is the speed of light. So information can only travel at or below the speed of light. So think about this. For object A to exact the gravitational force in object B, right, object A has to know the mass energy of object B. And this requires an exchange of information. And information cannot be transmitted faster than the speed of light. So what does this mean? Well, suppose now, little thought experiment, very simple one, imagine that object A and object B are 1 light-year apart. Okay? Then according to Newton's theory, if we allow gravitational waves into his theory, it would say that object A and object B being 1 light-year apart, it would mean that we would not have any gravitational effects of one object on the other before a full year.
Right.
No, that's not what happens. It is instantaneous. So what I'd like to do is describe how Einstein explained away this paradox. He did it in his theory of general relativity. According to general relativity, you see, the very shape of the universe, this is the geometry of space-time, is warped in the presence of regions of high mass energy. In other words, in the presence of massive objects, space, a black hole would cause space to wrap around itself. Mm. My cat? What do you want, cat?
Is that your cat making that sound? How does your cat make that sound?
Who knows?
I thought he was scratching at something.
Just crying. You can explain. The whole idea is that, if I can get down to the guts of it, the reason that this general relativity, the reason that it deals, that it explains the paradox in Newtonian physics of instantaneous effects of gravity is that it's because general relativity, the universe adapts its shape to mass energy information locally. And that is instantaneous because it's local. So what happens is when light's traveling, it's traveling on a natural geodesic. Maybe I should explain. A geodesic is defined, if you have a certain geometry, any geometry, all geometries have geodesics. Okay, so given two points in a geometry, a geodesic is defined to be a path of shortest length between them. Okay, light travels in geodesics. But you see, because length here, depends intuitive sometimes. For example, in Euclidean geometry, that's the geometry you learn in school. Mm-hmm. All the geodesics are straight line segments. How many times have you heard the distance between two points is a straight line?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, but
billions and billions of times.
Yeah.
Billions of times, that's right. But you see, on this, let's go to a different geometry, a spherical geometry. On the surface of the sphere, geodesics are not straight lines. They're great arcs.
Got it.
Which is why, say, you're flying from New York to Moscow, you may go over Greenland.
Ah.
Yeah, that's a geodesic there. It's the shortest path in the spherical geometry.
Kill nearly 2,500 people in the U.S. every year.
What is that?
I'm sorry, that was my cat.
Was that your cat?
No.
Very intelligent cat.
Something went awry there. Go ahead.
I thought it was me, actually.
No, go ahead.
So the fact is that if you think about this the way Newtonian physics would have you think about it, you would say, well, the natural geodesic is a straight line, but gravity is pulling on light. So it's pulling light off of its geodesic. And this just feeds into this paradox of instantaneous action. Relativity, gravity does not pull light off of its natural geodesic. Gravity actually creates a new geodesic by warping the fabric of space-time. Okay, so in other words, according to general relativity, it bends space-time in such a way that the altered path of light actually is a natural geodesic.
Would that be like, again, to illustrate this, going back to that mattress analogy,
sure,
where the mattress would be warped because of the bowling ball.
Yeah, you can say that. You can say that. And if you were traveling along, exactly. I like that.
Okay.
There you go. So the first indication of the importance of the findings of the SPICEP 2 experiment. The detection of gravitational waves provides an additional layer of support to Einstein's theory of general relativity. It's really pretty cool. And there's more. There's more. In the theory of general relativity, gravitational waves, and this is what you've read, I'm sure, Tom, you mentioned a moment ago, they're ripples in the curvature of space-time.
Right, yes.
Right?
Yes.
These ripples are usually referred to as quantum fluctuations.
Okay.
You may have seen that term, I'm not sure. But let's get back to particles. Although we tend to think of particles in the Newtonian sense, right, as tiny billiard balls, this is highly inaccurate, right? A particle, what a particle is, it's actually a quantum of waves in a field. For example, in the electromagnetic field, a single quantum of waves is what we call a photon. It's a particle of light.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So ripples in the curvature of space-time, they may well be particles that mediate the force of gravity. And these are hypothesized to exist. They're called gravitons.
Mm-hmm.
Gravitons are bosons, just like the Higgs boson, right? They're massless bosons that are hypothesized to exist. They've never been detected. But the detection of gravitational waves now lends credence to the existence of gravitons.
I see.
Yeah, and this is important because gravitons are not part of the current standard model of particle physics. All other bosons are. Okay, the gluon, you know, they all mediate different forces. You know, the photon, but the graviton is not. So who knows, may in the future become a part of the standard model because we now have evidence, at least we, as I say, it lends credence to the existence. This existence is still speculative, so I don't want to get ahead of myself.
My existence is now speculative. At this point, let me tell you, we're in the second hour here with Dr. Waldar, and whose new book is coming out soon. Let's see, I have the title of it here somewhere. No, was it you or that was another one of the titles that was going to go into my book of titles. I'm not going to write all these books. I'm just going to write a book about the title. What was it called? It's not. Weren't you here when we did that, Doc? No, you weren't here. It's not an equinox. Well, here it is, right here. It's not a solstice. It's an equinox.
Oh, yeah.
I want you to write that book so that we can get all this straight, okay? Here at Cthulhu Chronicles on April 24th. And, you know, a lot of you people who are listening, you know, do what Tom says. Just don't think. Just listen. And remember what it would cost you to have a class with Dr. Waldar. You're getting this for nothing here, Cthulhu Chronicles. Yeah, he doesn't do this for everybody. He's exclusive. And this is important, whether you know it or not. When you go tomorrow to turn over your car, you don't actually literally turn over your car. You turn over the engine. You don't turn over the engine literally. You just put the key in and turn the car on, and you get into the car. Just remember that the information this is all happening. And that's what's amazing to me, that the stuff that we don't particularly understand right off the bat when the doctor is talking, and that's why he can teach it and we can't, is this stuff is all happening to us. It's all going on right now, right? I mean, the gravitational and the information is going back. The stuff you're talking about is happening, even as we stood here.
It's very, very current. Also, when we did the show on Mars, that was extremely current.
Yeah.
Yeah, only on Cthulhu Chronicles, folks.
So write it all down and then look it up later, like Tom did, and meditate upon it.
Yeah, meditate, let it wash over. Do you remember when I had my waterbed?
Mm-hmm.
I got it, you know, I was trying to impress that girl, and I invited her over, and she said, the next time you're going to see me, it'll be light years before.
that affected you also.
Yes, it did.
Well, maybe you should have taken the bowling ball off of the bed when she came.
Oh, maybe that was the problem, yeah.
That's right. What you should have told her is that you can't talk about taking light years because light years is a distance.
That's right. Light years is distance. That's right, Tom.
That put her in her place.
You blew it, Tom.
Oh, man.
Light years is distance. And a lot of people, right, realize that they think time because of years.
I say, look, if you have the time, I have the space.
Yeah, and right, unfortunately, Tom's favorite planet was. I'm not going to do this joke. I'm not going to do the joke.
Okay, we all know.
Anyway. I'm not going to do it. All right, I will not do it.
Uranus.
Doc Waldar teaching at the very famous Villanova,
mm-hmm.
which is new light, new sun, the sun. No, Village of the Sun, isn't it?
New town.
Town?
New Village.
Oh, Villa of New. Nova New, not Nova Star yeah. Light. Okay.
Not Nova Star, but Nova New.
And how many people, I wonder how many people are sitting there, like they said, they're just running over and saying, well, let's go back to this Einstein thing. What on earth would he be saying right now based on what you're talking about and his theories compared to Newton?
he'd be saying, I've been right all along. I mean, his general relativity predicted the existence of gravitational waves, which is why this experiment, the findings in this experiment, helped to cement his theory. His general relativity also predicted the B-mode polarization. And as we're going to see later, and this is the most astonishing thing of all, his general relativity allows for a repulsive form of gravity.
A repulsive form of gravity? Hold on, I got another title. Where did it go? Where's my thing? A repulsive, this is the book I'm going to write after. I see, after it's not a solstice. Wait, a repulsive. You see, I hear already.
I hear you writing.
A repulsive form?
Of gravity.
Wow.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting. I hope I can get to that.
I hope so, too. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. That's all right.
As a title.
Yeah, I wanted to put something in perspective here, and that is, I mentioned this earlier, but I want to say it again. The detection of gravitational waves gives us a snapshot of a much younger universe than we've ever before witnessed, and by a long shot. In fact, it's really a relevance to this time period I mentioned. Once again, recall that light from the CMB, this can be traced back, that's cosmic microwave background. If it can be traced back to when the universe was approximately 380,000 years old, which is mm-hmm. roughly 2% of its present age.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what happens is, this happens to be, this is kind of a little of an offshoot, but this is known as the recombination epoch. It's the time when the universe, which was so intensely hot, it's the first time that it's sufficiently full to allow formation of hydrogen atoms. And at this time and for the next million years, hydrogen, helium, and lithium, those were the only atoms that were present. Now, prior to that time, we're talking about the universe as being a hot plasma. It had particles popping in and out of existence at a fantastic rate, but it was far too hot for atoms to form and remain stable. Okay, so to get back to this cosmic inflation, which again is supported by gravitational waves, and this is a model. I really have to touch on this because it's different than the conventional Big Bang model, so I do want to touch on that in a moment. But as I said earlier, this takes us back, if you think 380,000 years, if you think of the universe as being 380,000 years old, you think that was young, think about 10 to the minus 35 seconds old. And that's what we can witness now. That's what these gravitational waves are telling us. Now, the thing is, I do wish to compare that number. This is another fascinating thing. I want to compare the 10 to the minus 35 figure with 10 to the minus 43. That's a smaller number, 10 to the minus 43, right? So 10 to the minus 35 is 1 divided by a 1 followed by 35 zeros, but 10 to the minus 3 is a 1 followed by, divided by 1 followed by 43 zeros. Okay? Mm-hmm. What is the significance of this 10 to the minus 43 seconds? This is the shocker. This is how you define a single unit of Planck time. And due to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, a single unit of Planck time is the smallest measurable unit of time. It's indivisible. This is not philosophical. Okay, this is reality. This means that, what this means by the smallest unit of time, not only are we unable to answer what events might have occurred, say, during a half unit of the Planck time, but the question doesn't even make sense. According to the uncertainty principle, time isn't even defined for half units of Planck time. So what I'm saying here is essentially what this means is that this measurement made in the BICEP 2 experiment takes us back in time to within 100 million units of the smallest time frame of reality. And this is absolutely mind-blowing.
Wow, and I was late to work today. By what? Just even less time than that.
There is not less time than that. Haven't you been listening?
Well, that's what I told them, and they let me go. So.
Thanks. So Heisenberg saved your life.
Now, Doc, when we see in the various scenes of these Men in Black movies, and, mm-hmm. and we see that a universe is in a, you know, a keychain or a little piece of something or other, right?
Yeah, they soap show, bubbles or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, they show this comparison of size as we see it, mm-hmm. when in fact that there's something actually true about that in terms of size and stuff, right?
Well, yeah, but not in terms of the expanding universe again, because what happens, you cannot say that you're looking, okay, so maybe the people who are existing in this little bubble, maybe that little bubble for them is the observable universe. But because we're on the outside and then we're able to observe it, okay, it's not the universe. Okay, because the universe encompasses everything. There's no existing space, there's no existing time that's outside of the universe. So they would be under a misapprehension there to think that their observable universe is the entire universe.
I'll tell you what this does, though, in the course of human events. That makes Abraham Lincoln totally incorrect, because you said that the thing that's indivisible is not one country. It's... So he was wrong all along, right?
I didn't say that a Planck unit of time was the only thing that's in the book.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah, but you're right. So I want to get on now to the I talked about these two models. Okay, so I want to say that first, the detection of gravitational waves supports the theory of cosmic inflation. So I'm really going to talk about cosmic inflation. I referred to it a little earlier, but now I'm going to go into some detail.
Okay, you better start that now. Now we're at here's Cotolo Chronicles. We're at the last 40 minutes here now. So here's Dr. Waldo now talking more about, explaining more about that.
Yes. Yeah, so there's two very different models of the Big Bang. One without cosmic inflation, which is called the conventional Big Bang, and the other with cosmic inflation, which is called the inflationary Big Bang. Now, I guess I already talked about the fact that the bang really wasn't a bang, but the point is, the theory, the Big Bang is not about a bang, and it never was, okay? The conventional Big Bang theory without inflation is only about the aftermath of the Big Bang. The study starts with all the matter in the universe already in place, already undergoing rapid expansion, already incredibly hot. But there's no explanation as to how it got that way.
Mm. Okay.
Moreover, so expansion in this conventional Big Bang was due to this enormous thermal pressure that was combined to a very small place, a hot Big Bang, if you will. Okay. Now, in the inflationary model, there were actually two separate expansions. And this is, you know, this is, a lot of people don't realize this. Many. Yeah. One of these expansions was the type we just discussed in the hot model. Okay, so it had this enormous thermal pressure, very hot temperatures that were confined to a very small region. But in the inflationary model, there's an earlier expansion, which is referred to as cosmic inflation. And here's the thing. This earlier expansion occurred when the universe was extremely cold, barely above absolute zero.
Mm.
Now, the inflationary Big Bang theory is also, it's also not a theory about the ultimate beginning, because it needs some matter to get started. Not much, maybe just a gram's worth. But it does, the inflationary model does help to explain the hot Big Bang and other features of the universe. So again, as I said earlier, one should not interpret expansion as an explosion, okay, something that's being propelled into pre-existing space, right? So instead of thinking of expansion as an inner force that's propelling outward or pushing, I want you to think, to interpret expansion as an outward force that's pulling. And the question is, what could this mysterious force be that's actually pulling? And there are two plausible answers, and there's only two. One is dark energy, and the other one is a repulsive form of gravity. And now, they're very different. It's very, very important I note this. They may be the same thing. Okay, dark energy may actually be the realization of a repulsive form of gravity. But dark energy is a fairly generic description. Okay, and we'll get into why it's called that in a second. Gravity as a repulsive force is very specific. It's gravity doing exactly the opposite of what you'd expect it to do. You drop the apple and it falls upward.
Okay.
So here we are talking about this mysterious force that's generating expansion by pulling from the outside. And the question you should have is, the outside of what?
Oh, that's one of the questions for sure.
You interpret it as a force event or a force or energy, you know, that exists in the unobservable universe, which is pulling on the observable universe. And that's why we cannot see it. And that is why we call this mysterious pulling force dark energy. That's the only reason. Because it can't be seen by us. It's in the unobservable universe. But it is pulling. It's pulling outward the observable universe. Now I want to get into, that's generic. Let's get into a repulsive form of gravity. Okay, it goes against everything we're taught. we agree on that, right?
Yes.
We were educated to believe that gravity is only an attractive force.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so again, the apple falls to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
In the absence of gravity, it'll stay afloat, but never, it's inconceivable for us to think that it's going to fall upward away from the Earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, that's because our sense of direction is based on gravity, right? Up and down and left and right, but with no gravity, out of space, there's no up and down and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Just want to make sure I'm on that page, you know?
Yeah.
Go.
Well, first I want to discuss, what's the problem with gravity being only an attractive force? What's the big deal if gravity is in reality only an attractive force? And the answer is, it's a big problem. And to explain this, you see, all the other fundamental forces in the universe are both attractive and repulsive. Take, for example, electromagnetism. Oppositely charged atoms attract, like charged atoms repel. So it's attractive and repulsive. This is also true. The four fundamental forces are gravity, electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force. And it turns out that all but gravity, so the electromagnetic force and the weak and strong nuclear forces, are both attractive and repulsive. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if it is indeed the case that gravity is only attractive, then that creates an enormous obstacle to solving what's arguably the biggest puzzle in all physics, and that's to find a unified field theory.
So I've heard that term bandied about.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to
explain it a little.
The unified field theory, what this is, it's an attempt to unify the four fundamental forces, which I've mentioned, right, into a single cogent description. And Einstein spent nearly his entire life attempting to do this, to find a unified field theory, and he failed. So let's talk about unification, because it really isn't anything new. You see, once upon a time, scientists believed that electricity and magnetism were different, that they were unrelated. But it's since been shown that they're one and the same force, and that's why we refer to it today as electromagnetic force. That is an example of unifying forces. That's unification. Now, in more recent times, electromagnetism has been unified with the weak nuclear force. And it's called the electroweak force. But you see, there's an enormous difference, a very essential difference between these two examples I just gave. And that is, electricity and magnetism behave alike in our present world. But electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force appear to have nothing in common. So in what sense can we call these two forces, electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force? In what sense can we call them unified? And here's the answer to this. So it's been shown that at extremely high temperatures, for example, those temperatures that that would have occurred shortly after the Big Bang, electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force would have been indistinguishable. So the only reason that these forces behave so differently in our current universe is due to the fact that these extreme temperatures are no longer present. This is an example, another term you might have heard. This is an example of what's called symmetry breaking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So we're back to this problem. What we'd like to do is find a unified field theory. And the very notion of the Big Bang, by the way, has its origins in creating a seed for the unified field theory. That was the initial aim of the Big Bang theory.
Mm.
Yeah, so here's the seed of the idea. Once upon a time, there was only one force. And it occurred when the universe was under this intense thermal pressure. Mm-hmm. Then as the universe cooled and expanded, there was symmetry breaking occurring at various epochs. And now the main problem. This explanation of unification works very well for the three non-gravitational forces. Electromagnetism, weak nuclear force, strong nuclear force. But how can one possibly extend the unification principle to gravity if gravity is in fact only purely attractive force? And the answer is you cannot. Because no amount of thermal energy is sufficient to explain how symmetry breaking could produce a purely attractive force from this unified force that was once attractive and repulsive. Okay, however, as it turns out, and this is the big drum roll, gravity is not a purely attractive force.
Oh, sorry.
No, thank you.
Just trying to assimilate that to the microphone. What is it? What drum rolls?
Slope your drum roll. The drum roll we get to.
Okay, hold on. Okay, go.
Gravity is not a purely attractive force. And the...
Wait, we just missed it. It somehow your voice came in and out there. But the information, remember, is not traveling as quickly as... So this cyber connection we have. Say... Okay, here we go. Go again.
Gravity is not a purely attractive force. It can be, under certain circumstances, it can be a repulsive force as well.
Mm.
Although, admittedly, we don't observe this in everyday life. Now, here's the thing. Einstein's theory of general relativity actually allows for a repulsive form of gravity. Mathematically, gravity will act as a repulsive force on material with a negative pressure. And this is, remember, general relativity says that gravity is not just a reaction to mass and energy. It's also something that reacts to pressure. And the point is that if gravity acts on material with negative pressure, it will act as a repulsive force. Okay, so again, right, it's not just matter densities or energy densities, it's pressure. Now, the idea is that when you have a positive pressure, you create a normal gravitational field, the kind we're accustomed to. But mm-hmm. a negative pressure operates differently. Now, it also is the case that materials with negative pressure are easy to construct. For example, pull a rubber band and hold it.
Wait, I got one right here. Let's do this.
Yeah, me too.
I want to do this. Go ahead. Okay,
right.
Go.
You have it. Now hold it in a stretched position.
Don't hold it in what?
A stretched position.
Okay.
Okay.
That rubber band now has negative pressure.
Negative pressure?
Yes, it does.
Because it shouldn't be expanded?
Because it's being stretched.
All right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, all other things being equal, so gravity will act as a repulsive force on matter that has negative pressure. And so what happens is, insofar as the detection of gravitational waves is supporting cosmic inflation, it's also supporting this Einstein idea of a repulsive form of gravity, and in doing so, it creates now a possibility of actually being able to formulate a unified field theory. So that's just another incredible outcome of this.
Let me ask you a question in terms of stretching the, and this is not a joke. It's going to sound like it because I'm an absolute idiot. But now, when I stretch this and it's negative, and you said it would defy gravity. I mean, it would repulse gravity.
Gravity would act repulsively on that rubber band.
So is that why if I let it go when I shoot the rubber band, it goes? And gravity doesn't take it down right away? I mean, is that why it flies?
That's a great question. The answer is
no. Is it? Oh, thank goodness I asked. That means I understood something.
That's a good question.
Okay.
No. That's just it's falling. When you shoot a rubber band across the room, it's falling at the same rate as if you drop it.
Oh, is it? See, I learned something right there.
Yeah.
So that's not repulsive. That's exactly what should happen.
Yes, but I mean, the fact is, when I'm talking about repulsive form of gravity, you're not going to experience this form.
Not I.
You pull the rubber band backwards, but the fact is that the repulsive form of gravity, this is such a minute piece of matter that's under negative pressure, mm-hmm. that you would never see the effects of repulsive gravity.
Okay.
What happens, you know, everything would be dominated by all the mass and energy that's around. But the point is, we're talking about what's going on in the unobservable universe. So in the unobservable universe, there may be that gravity never is observed observed. If you're living in the unobservable universe somehow, then you may, of course, then the unobservable universe becomes observable to you.
Some people think I live in an unobservable universe.
I'm one of them.
Yes, I am. I think I've just discovered the largest number ever.
Right.
Yeah. It's the number of reasons why I am not in your class. It's infinite.
I actually invited Frank to come and speak to my class.
Can you believe this? I might still do. Imagine me. So, I think it would be.
I'd like to have seen that.
How would you explain? Well, anyway, let's not talk about me. Let's go back to this. Yeah, and you know what else? What?
Right. So what happens is that you have to understand in the unobservable universe, everything would be different. Okay, so it may have its own physical laws. Our laws may be, you know, maybe gravity only is observed to repel there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and stuff like that. So, what I'm mainly talking about, when I talk about the inflationary model, I should say, is Alan Guth, G-U-T-H. Alan Guth is a theoretical physicist at MIT. And he's the leading proponent of this inflationary Big Bang theory. And again, it's taking place, remember, prior to the hot Big Bang. So the inflationary model has two Big Bangs. And this first one is taking place when the universe is barren and very cold and very small, of course. Okay, so what happens is that based on these experimental findings, physicists who are accepting these findings, they have no doubt, do not doubt at all the validity of this inflationary model. So this is very, very important. The inflationary model does more, though. It also explains why the universe is so uniform and why the universe is so flat.
Flat.
Yes, the universe is flat. Now, remember the universe is multidimensional. I mean, it's not the same thing when you talk about flat. It's not like talking about the Earth is flat. Okay, we're talking about because those who might have proposed that the Earth was flat, they're basically talking about flatness at a much lower dimensional level. Okay, so
okay, we're getting at the concepts. My Newtonian brain.
Newtonian.
It's like, whoa. A flat universe, that again implies, well, it's in relation to something else. Otherwise, if it's everything, how could it be flat? You know, I mean, flat is a concept of space and
Measurability.
Shape.
There's a problem here. Problem is that you're tending to think about flat like, say, a piece of paper.
Right.
Okay, but that's just something that's two dimensions.
So we have another definition of flat?
Oh, yes. Yeah, by flat, what we mean is that the universe, when we say it's flat, we mean that it has either something very close to zero curvature. Okay, it's a mathematical term.
Mm-hmm.
But it basically means that space is locally Euclidean. So, for example, if you look around you in the universe, you know, not the universe, but your room,
mm-hmm.
you tend to think of your room as being Euclidean because it's three dimensions and as far as you can see in your room, you take two points in your room, the geodesic will be a straight line, that's Euclidean.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the universe is locally that way. It has this zero curvature or something very close to the zero curvature. And the question is, why is the universe that way? And also, why is it so uniform? And what I mean by uniform is that it has the same physical properties at all points and in all directions. So then technically, you would say the universe is homogeneous and the universe is isotropic. But these are just notions that the universe is the same, no matter where you look from a single point or what your experience is at a variety of points. All the same physical laws you behold. And the question is, why is it this way? And here's the thing. The conventional Big Bang model offers nothing in the way of an explanation of these two phenomena, right, being uniform and being flat. Instead, the conventional Big Bang model, what it does is it assumes some very highly tuned initial conditions at the moment of the Big Bang that would result in what we see today. So it's like a fudge factor.
It's like a what?
A fudge factor.
Ah, the fudge factor comes into play.
The fudge factor.
So, you know, why is the universe the way it is today? We cannot explain it, but if, in fact, at the time of the Big Bang, we have these very highly tuned initial conditions, then things will result in what we see today. That does not offer anything in the way of an explanation. But in contrast, the inflationary Big Bang model offers very credible explanations of these phenomena. To be specific, according to the inflationary model, the reason the universe is so uniform is because once it was so infinitesimally small that it had enough time prior to inflation to become uniform, much like the way a cup of coffee cools to room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So during the inflationary period, the universe expanded too quickly to disrupt the uniformity. And likewise, it expanded too rapidly to disrupt the flatness with a zero curvature. But again, let me say, keep in mind that we're only talking about the observable universe here. So the unobservable universe may be uniform, it may have a non-zero curvature, they have very large curvature, and it may again have its own set of physical laws that don't apply. They're diametrically opposed to what we see. So I figured out an analogy that I could discuss. Think about laying a carpet.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how when you're laying it, you're spreading the carpet flat as you lay it. And the carpet, this laying of the flatness causes the carpet to bunch up at the extremities.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this analogy, you know, best I could do, the flat uniform carpet would be the observable universe, and this outward bunched up area, these extremities, would be the boundary between the observable and the unobservable universe. So in this analogy, so it may be a little deeper than you think, the analogy, because what we're saying is that the universe tends to flatten out as it expands. Think about that. So as it's expanding, it's flattening. Okay. Now remember, it's being pulled by this dark energy, which may very well be this repulsive force of gravity that's existing in the unobservable universe. Okay. But what's happening is as it's pulling, the carpet is, the universe is tending to flatten just like the carpet does.
Wow. Here in the Cotolo Chronicles, okay, here's where we're at right now. Here is where we're at right now, which is bad English, but this is the location of our discussion. We have to kind of wrap it up into some, not a resolution, but maybe a quotient, maybe not an answer at all, but something really to think about based on what we went into about the gravitational wave, so that we don't leave this entirely out. And you know, we didn't even talk about it. I want to do this next time. I want to talk about that new planet they found. We haven't even talked. I know there's no time to talk about that. Did you hear about the, what is it, 500 light years away, and it's very much like Earth? Did you hear about that?
No. Much like Earth. I don't know the exact distance.
Okay. I thought it was 500.
Skylar and I can return to talk about that sometime.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk about that, because that was really, well, they made it sound like, you know, there actually could be, not just, there might be 1 hour Martinizing there for all we know. let's look at this topic today, and now let's take the next 10 minutes to put this into some kind of perspective that everybody could walk away with and say, well, what is this? Go, Doc.
Well, there is one more thing I wanted to bring up, which is going to be very brief, and that is that there are models. This is not necessarily Guth's model, but there are models of the inflationary Big Bang. I'm bringing this up because it'll bring up something you've heard.
Okay.
And I won't go into detail about it. But some of the models of the inflationary Big Bang suggest that cosmic inflation didn't just happen once, but that it's continuing to occur over and over in certain regions of this ever-expanding space. Kind of like how the seeds of a plant would spread out new plants.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is this kind of inflation, by the way, this is what's referred to as eternal inflation, and it leads to what's commonly called the theory of the multiverse. Right. So this is the base. You've heard people talk about multiverse, which you know means many, many universes. This is really the seed of it. This whole idea of eternal inflation that's actually reproducing the inflation in the inflationary model of the Big Bang, the inflation when the universe was cold, happening in very extreme regions of space over and over and over again as we undergo the current expansion that is really part of the hot Big Bang. Yeah, so that's it. Really, I've said just about all I really wanted to. I would sum it up by saying this is really, we have to be a little bit cautious. We have to, I would say, exercise a cautious optimism about the findings here. Let's hope for the Five Sigma experiment. Let's hope that it's repeated by various experimental teams and corroborated, because once this is actually shown, there is just an amazing amount of information that we now know, we can now say, at that point in time at least, should it happen, we'd be able to say that general relativity now has gained support, the existence of gravitons has gained support, the inflationary universe has. Again, we are able to see the most infinitesimal amount of time after the Big Bang. So, yeah, this is all earth-shattering news. Let's be cautious about it, but let's realize that if it is so, the impact is beyond incredible.
Tom, what do you have to say about that? What have you grasped that equals that energy of that that statement of earth-shattering information?
I'll say that tomorrow you may find me a grave man. this information is, it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
I, you know, it's funny because I feel like when you mentioned the poll of the students who said, no, I don't buy this. I could see, I'm not going there, but I could see why they would say that, you know.
It's just because they just want something more, they want something they could understand, something simpler, that they don't want, they're intimidated by the truth, actually, huh?
Yeah, I think that's
Doc, do you find that a lot of this stuff just intimidates people so they just dismiss it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think I want to go on record, too, as saying that Frank, you and Tom, you as well, really have done a great job. I mean, I feel that you've really grasped a lot of what I was trying to say. So kudos to you both.
This is I'm going to dedicate my book, which I'm going to, on the Big Bang, which I'm going to begin writing as soon as this show is over.
What's the title?
When You Whoosh Upon a Star.
That's great. When You Whoosh Upon a Star.
Yeah, I like that.
Very nice.
That's brilliant.
I'm happy that I get more, you know, a good grade. I don't give myself a good grade on anything, but certainly not this. I do have a grasp, but I guess it's hard for, like Tom, if you agree with me, it's hard for us to explain it the way you do, explain the grasp that we have. It's almost ineffable to us, you see?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I do have concepts that I cannot explain in your areas of expertise. I know.
I'm sorry, Frank.
Go ahead.
Let me ask the doctor, like, what would be someone at our level, what would be like a good book about these subjects, you know, quantum physics or the gravitational waves?
I would start with Hawking. He wrote that excellent book, A Brief History of Time. In fact, I think it was followed by A Briefer History of Time.
Smaller book.
actually it is. It's more, it has more information in it. And it's explained, the man's brilliant, we all know that, but he's also a brilliant expositor. So, I would definitely read that. That'll probably touch upon, special and general relativity. As far as quantum mechanics, I don't know that there is, you could look for, maybe, you know, that series, This and That for Idiots. I think there's actually quantum mechanics for idiots.
Wow.
Yeah. Dummies.
I'm going to get that one tomorrow.
Dummies.
Yeah. I'm thinking of getting it myself.
Is there another series for idiots and one for dummies?
maybe I meant dummies. You're right.
No, I just finished,
I think they're competing, the idiots and the dummies.
I just finished one of them. I bought, it's a ventriloquism for dummies.
Oh,
there I go. See, that's why, teachers, not like Dr. Woldorf, of course, he's a teacher with a sense of humor and he's actually a human being. I know because I've broken bread with him, so I understand. But, old teachers, teachers like Tom and I used to talk about, you know, they hated me for that. But, it's Stephen Hawking. I already knows him. It's the two books are
A Brief History of Time.
And A Briefer History of Time.
And A Briefer History of Time.
It's books, but I think Ian Anderson was an author of a book that was a bit interesting about, the universe, various aspects of the universe, how one can look up in the sky and see two different images of the same star because of the shape of the universe, and because of, gravity. What else? There are some really good books that for lay people, but I don't know of any that really are on quantum physics. Quantum physics is highly mathematical, and to study it, you really have to go through some advanced mathematics. You have to actually understand Lie algebras and Lie groups.
How long do you think it'll take now? Because you said we have to be a little skeptical about this particular finding, and I'm asking you to come up with a prediction or what have you. But does it look like it's going to be a very long time before this either becomes proven or not?
My best guess is within 2 years.
Okay, that's good.
How many planks is that?
How many plank units? A lot.
A lot. The difference a lot and infinitesimal. Well,
it's what followed by billions and billions.
Billions. Poor guy. That's what we do. The poor, great guy, and that's what we do. That we just sit here and mock him.
No.
That's not you. You know.
Remembered for?
Huh?
That's what he'll be remembered for. That's his trademark.
Yeah. You think that he'd. I don't know. I didn't know him.
Well, even though I
have a sense of humor, I think.
Say that and joke like that. I appreciate him a great deal.
Absolutely. And by the way, unlike a lot of lay expositors, people who write books for the lay audience, mm-hmm. He was actually a brilliant scientist.
I felt so bad when he died. I don't understand it because I didn't have the same feeling about Clark Gable, you know. When Carl Sagan died, it felt so bad. Isn't that weird?
He was a passionate. You felt the passion he had for what he was teaching us and what he was learning himself. It was, and that I think it just spilled over onto us.
And rebooting the cosmos, we have to thank if you liked it, and I think it's pretty good. I've been watching some of them. I think we have to thank the people who put the money, huh?
They take a few liberties in the show, but it is very good.
See, there goes Dr. Waldor again. See, we would never know that. He knows, but wait a second. That's great. I could like to watch Cosmos with you. Then we have to thank Seth MacFarlane, of all people, for putting up a tremendous amount of money for that. And the people who bring you Fox News, believe it or not. That's odd, isn't it?
It's on Fox, isn't it?
Not just on Fox. A great deal of the money came from News Corp. So if you watch the Fox News channel, they'll be complaining about how nobody believes in creation.
Well, that's our irony.
And then the money put towards, you know, then they take their other money and they put it on conservative shows like Louie and Cosmos. So it just goes to show you the universe may be flat, but things are bouncing all over the place. Doc, thank you again, and let me know the next time you're available, because I know you're incredibly busy.
I will. I'd actually like to come on with Tom again, too, sometime.
Well, thank you. And it was really a pleasure.
Well, we could do it next.
Sharing this with you.
We may be able to do it next month. And we could if we could get four on here, we can get Sky in here also. We'd really have a...
That would be great.
Yeah, we'll have a what is that called? A panel? A panel or something? Yeah, we got it. Okay, so we got that. Thank you, Doc. Tom, you can hold on because Tom and I are going to talk afterwards.
All right.
And
my pleasure, Frank.
Thank you. Thank you again. And we'll, we'll see you in my dreams.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Now, I think as soon as he hangs up, that'll be it. I don't think if I hang up now, I'll hang up on both these. I don't want to do that. What I want to do is do this here. Because we'll be moving on out here. So Tom, what do you think?
Wow!
Wow! It boggles, literally boggles the mind. What a great guy!
Incredible.
We'll get more and more from him. And don't forget to be listening on the news and all the news for my new books, A Repulsive Form of Gravity, The Fudge Factor. And When You Wish Upon a Star. I'll be telling you more. Tom and I will be talking, but say goodbye and take. Thank you, Tom, again.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay. And Tom, we're going to get. Tom is going to be on again, not just with Dr. Waldorf, we're going to get Tom Martin on. Otherwise known as Milt Martin, TV talk show pioneers. he'll be there also, and until then I guess we'll be back in May as we move along. I don't know what will happen next week, but keep watching. Get me at Facebook. Tom is at TJ Savino. Twitter?
At Twitter, that's correct.
At Frank Cotolo, Twitter, and Tom's not on Facebook. I am, you know where I am there, and then where else? All the other places. If I look, Google us, Google plus, minus, whatever you got to do. Until then, what? Good night, Mrs. Ernstweil, wherever you are. And we'll leave you now because I have, and we have, nothing more to say.
球到冰球，小村到大市，啊，咸湿屋仔到咸湿中心，系 Cthulhu Chronicles。